Well, it's Christmas season, I'm not sure there's anything more central to Christmas than giving gifts, right? There's food, there's family, there's trees, there's decorations, there's Jesus, there's the manger, there's all of those things. There's Christmas songs, there's drums, and yet, let's be honest, what do we think of, what dominates our time and energy more than anything else during Christmas? It's buying gifts, it's giving gifts, it's opening gifts, it's playing with gifts on Christmas Day, it's taking gifts back the next day. But whatever it is, it's giving gifts, and I love it as adults, we still love it as kids, we loved it. We complain about shopping now, but now we can just go on Amazon and get everything. Like, we don't even have to go shopping, we don't have to leave our house, we can still buy gifts. I mean, nobody complains so much that they go, I'm just not going to give any gifts this year. Like, we still give gifts because we just love doing it. One of the traditions we've had at our house is we've made Christmas lists every year. And they love to, like, sit down, and they'll do it now in, like, October. And they'll sit down and make a list of all the gifts that they want. And I asked Marin this morning, Marin is our six-year-old daughter, asked her if I could share a little bit from her Christmas list that she made 2 months ago. And she said, yes, I can share that with everyone, because then everyone will know what to buy her for Christmas. So, this is Marin's list, and this is part of it. Number one, spy gear. She wants spy gear. I don't know who she wants to spy on, but she wants spy gear. She wants a microphone. Big surprise there. A new dress, clothes, stuffed animal Beanie Boo, which I didn't know what a Beanie Boo was, but now I do. They're pretty popular. Diary, she wants Legos, she wants a Georgia Tech shirt. So she's a Georgia Tech fan, not because of last night, but she was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and we've never lived there since then, and she's never been to Georgia Tech, but she loves Georgia Tech because that's where she's from. And she wants a map of the world, scooters, pajamas, a picture of me, she said. No, not me, not me. She wrote a picture of me on her list. That would be good. No, she wants a picture of herself. I did ask to put on her wall. I did ask her some clarifying questions about that. And she said, well, it can have mommy and daddy in it too. But then last, she said she wants a Bible that has the Old Testament. Isn't that funny? I asked her, I was like, what do you mean? Because we have all these kid Bibles that they read. And she was like, well, those are just have stories about Jesus in them. I want one with the Old Testament. And I was like, that's my girl. Like, awesome. Now, here's the deal. As fun as it is to talk about Christmas gifts and buying them and opening them and all that's going to happen during Christmas season, I want to ask a simple question. And it's this, we're going to buy a lot of gifts for our families, for brothers and sisters, parents, for kids, for nieces, nephews, extended families. We'll buy gifts for friends. We'll even buy gifts and give them to coworkers. But what gift are we going to give Jesus this year? I mean, if it's his birthday, you know, as the saying goes, if he's the reason for the season, if that's why we're gathered, if that's why this whole celebration is all about to begin with, what gift or gifts should we give him? Should we give Jesus this year? Have you thought about that? Have you ever sat down? Have you ever made a list? Have you ever thought about, like, making a list? Here's the things Jesus. I mean, if we gather and we celebrate this time where God gave his most precious gift, his own son, to us, that's what Christmas is about. Would we ever take the time to sit down and make a list of, here's what I want to give you this year? Would we ever be like the little drummer boy and stop and think, what's the finest gift that I can get? Even if I don't have very much, what can I give to Jesus this year? That's a hard question. Because you know those people in your life that have everything? For me, it's like my parents. It's usually our parents. And they have like everything. And they're the kind of people where you have no idea what to give them because they seem like they have everything in the world. Well, Jesus is kind of that way, right? Like he has everything. And he's not even really a person in the way our spouses or our families are people that we can actually give these sort of tangible gifts to. So how do you give something, or what do you give to someone who seems like they have everything and we don't even know how to give a gift to him? Well, that's what we're going to talk about for the next 3 weeks. And the way I want to do it is I want to explore the most familiar stories of Christmas. And we've heard these stories so often, and for some of you, maybe if you're new to church and the Bible can seem overwhelming, it'll be easy for the next 3 weeks because you already know the stories that we're going to read. But we'll actually see some things and learn some things about these stories that'll help us understand some of the things that we think about these stories aren't true. That there's some parts of the stories that actually aren't in the Bible that maybe we thought they were. So there's going to be some surprises over the next few weeks, but maybe more than anything else, I just want to reread these stories and ask the question, what do they tell us and how do they challenge us about what we could give to Jesus this year for Christmas? So here's what I want you to do. Turn in your Bible to Matthew chapter 2. If you didn't bring one or you don't have one, just you can grab one of the ones in the seat in front of you. Matthew chapter 2. Matthew is the first book of the New Testament, so just try to find your way to that. It's about two-thirds or three-fourths of the way through the Bible. And interestingly enough, there's four Gospels or four stories about Jesus' life. Remember Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Two of them don't tell us anything about his birth. Mark and John don't give us any stories about when or how Jesus was born. They start their stories a little differently from the others. So the two main stories we have are from Matthew and Luke. And they're familiar stories. Next week, we'll look at the one from Luke. But today, we're going to look at the one from Matthew. And this is what Matthew says, starting in chapter 2, verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, magi from the east came to Jerusalem and they asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and we have come to worship him." Now if we stop there for a second, Matthew actually doesn't tell us much about the actual birth of Jesus. He says a few things in the verses before, and we'll come back in a couple weeks and read those. But he starts off right here after Jesus was born. And he tells us exactly when and where it happened. He says he was born during the time of King Herod. Well, first he says he was born in Bethlehem of Judea. So he's born in this town in the Roman province of Judea, which was part of the Roman Empire at the time. And he was born during the time of King Herod. King Herod was half Jewish, half Arab. And he was a client king. He was somebody that Rome had helped put in power. So he was the king over the province of Judea at this time. And so Matthew's telling us right off from the beginning, I just want you to let you know, this isn't a fairy tale. This isn't like a legend. This isn't just a myth or something I made up. Like, this is a historical event. This actually took place in a real town at a real time during King Herod. You know, you can go check my facts on this one. This is what happened. And he tells us that after it happens, these magi come from the east to the capital city of the province, Jerusalem. That was the capital where Herod would have lived, the king in his palace. They come to Jerusalem and they say, "Where is the one who's been born king of Jews? We saw his star when it rose and we've come to worship him." Now, these magi are interesting. Magi is the literal Greek word that is often translated in our older versions as wise men. So we all know these are the three wise men, right? There's three of them. But it doesn't say that anywhere. So we don't know that for certain. Actually, that's a tradition that arose about 6 centuries later. So 6 centuries later, somebody got the idea that there were only three of them, and they even started writing down their names. There was this legend about what their names were, and they were kings, and so they had crowns on their head and all those things. And that's what goes into all of our manger scenes, but that's not what the Bible says. It just says this group of magi. Maybe there were three of them. Maybe there were four. Maybe there were six. Maybe there were eight. Maybe there were 10 or 12. Scholars don't know, but it's possible that there were more than three. Now, Magi refers to this group of men, and we've got other writings. This isn't just from the New Testament. We've got other historical writings that describe this group of men who were probably from Persia, maybe as far away as India, but probably from Persia, and they were like a priestly caste of men, and they specialized in interpreting dreams and interpreting the signs in the heavens. In a sense, they were like astronomers. They could look in the heavens and try to understand what certain stars meant and how they moved across the sky. But honestly, they were more like astrologers. So they saw these signs in the heaven, and they thought that certain signs in the heaven and the way celestial bodies moved across the sky would foretell famines, or would foretell significant events, or would foretell new kings or emperors that were about to rise up. And so these men, they also practiced forms of sorcery. They would practice magic and things like that. That's actually where we get the word magic from, is from this word magi. And so these men are hundreds of miles away, probably in Persia, and they're doing their job. They're interpreting dreams and they're interpreting signs. They're this sort of upper class of men that do it for the king of Persia. And they see this star in the sky way off to the west. And we don't know. There are some scientists and astronomers today who have figured out there were certain conjunctions of planets that took place around that time that would have been extra bright, and think maybe that's it. Maybe it was just totally supernatural. We don't know. But they saw this huge bright star in the sky, and for them, they interpreted it as this huge sign that a new king, a king of the Jews — these men were not Jewish, they were Persian, they didn't worship Israel's God, Yahweh — but they interpreted this great sign far off in the west as a sign that a new king born to the Jews had been born. And it was so significant and so important that they packed up their belongings and they packed up an entourage and they began the long journey hundreds of miles to the west. And they eventually arrive in Jerusalem, which was the capital, because where else would a king be born? That was the capital, right? It's probably one of Herod's own sons. That's the way it works. And so look at what happens next when they get to Jerusalem. Matthew, he continues in verse 3. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. In Bethlehem, in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. But you — and this is from the book of Micah in the Old Testament — but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel. So these magi show up and they say, we've come because this great king has been born and we want to worship him. We want to — and not worship, like they're not going to break out their guitars and start singing like choruses and songs and have a worship service. For them, worship just meant we want to pay our respect and our homage and our honor. We want to bow down before him as this great king who's been born. So they tell Herod this, and naturally it says Herod is disturbed, because Herod is the king. He's the one in charge. He's the one that calls the shots. And in fact, we know that Herod was a ruthless king. Herod was half Jewish and half Arab, as I said before. He had taken the throne by killing off members of his own family. And then he had traveled to Rome and he had gotten approval from the Roman Senate. And they had given him approval to go back and become king. And so he comes back to Jerusalem. This is many years before. He came back to Jerusalem with his armies, and he basically conquered the place. And then he eliminated any other threats there would be to his rulership over Judea. And he had been in power at this time more than 30 years. And he had told the people that he believed in their God, and he had allowed the Jews to continue practicing their worship the way they wanted at the temple and all those things. But there are always questions about whether he really cared about that. He cared a whole lot more about his building projects and ruling with an iron fist. And so when these guys show up, who Herod might be going like, I don't believe in any of your astrology kind of stuff. We don't know if Herod actually believed or not. But the fact that they show up and they say, a new king has been born and we want to worship him, like, that's threatening. And Herod doesn't like it. So the first thing he does is he's disturbed, and he gets his own religious leaders and his own sort of magi, if you will, and he says, like, is this true? Tell me what you think about all of this. And they say, well, actually, in our prophets, if we go back to our ancient writings, there's all kinds of stories about one day a Messiah. And back then, Messiah just meant a new anointed one, a new king. A new deliverer would rise up and one day would help lead the people of Israel and would restore the kingdom of Israel. We wouldn't be under Rome's oppression anymore, but a new Messiah will rise up and it'll come out of the lineage of David. Remember King David, who was amazing and awesome 1,000 years before? And where was David from? David was from this little village, only 5 miles away from Jerusalem, a little village called Bethlehem. And there were these writings that said one day a new king, a new deliverer, a new Messiah would emerge among the people of Israel, and he would come from the lineage of David, and he might even be born in the same town, in little Bethlehem. And so these religious leaders tell Herod this, and look at what Herod does in response. Next verse, verse 7. Says, then Herod called the Magi secretly, and he found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, and he said, go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him. So Herod's smart. He calls the Magi back in, and he's not, again, he's not sure if he believes them. He's not sure if there's been any great birth or any new king. But if there has, or even if there's a rumor that there has, he doesn't want that rumor getting out. He's going to squelch it no matter what. As he calls the Magi in and he says, hey, I too want to worship this new king that's been born. So could you tell me exactly when did you first see this star appear? Because he wants to calculate, like, when did this happen? Was it like weeks ago? Months ago, years ago, because I mean, they've traveled hundreds of miles. I mean, that didn't, you know, they didn't pack up and leave the day before and hop on a plane and get to Jerusalem. And so when did you first see this star? Because I too want to go. And so why don't you go and find him and worship him and then come back and tell me and then I'll go and worship him as well. And we know later that the Magi told him, well, actually, we saw the star. We started seeing it about 1 or 2 years ago. Like, that's when we first started seeing it. That's when it appeared, and it took us a while to pack up and decide we're going to come here and then to travel all the way here. So, our manger scenes, they have these wise men in the manger on the night that Jesus was born. It's actually not true. This takes place a lot later. In fact, one tragic ending to the story, we're not going to really read it, and we'll have to talk about it another time, is that what Herod does is when he finds out that these Magi saw this star 12, 16, 18, 20 months before, he calculates, well, that's when this child was born. And so he orders the slaughter of any children that are 2 years and younger that were born in Bethlehem at that time. Now, Bethlehem wasn't huge, so we're not talking about thousands of children here. Maybe 10 or 20 children, still tragic. And that's another story to talk about. But it tells us that this all takes place about a year or two later, so that when the Magi do say, okay, we'll go and find this new king and we'll worship him, and they arrive, they're not arriving at a manger with Jesus just having been born. It took place, probably Jesus is like crawling, he's talking, he's getting crazy at this point. Like, he's doing all those things, that the terrible twos, you know? That's Jesus at this point. And Matthew even gives us a clue to this as we keep reading. Look at what it says in the next verse. Verse 9. After they heard the king, they went on their way. And the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. And on coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and they worshipped him. So it says the star appears again. Again, we don't know how, if it's supernatural or something that we could explain scientifically. We're not sure, but it appears, and it leads them, and they come, and it wouldn't have been, like I said, it's only 5 miles away. It wouldn't have been a long journey to get to Bethlehem at that point. They get to Bethlehem, and then it says they come into the manger, right? No, it says they come into the house. Because Joseph and Mary are living in a house at this point. Now, Joseph and Mary actually were originally from Nazareth. We know that later. And they come down to Bethlehem right before Jesus' birth for various reasons. Part of it is because they had relatives and they had ancestors there and they needed to register for a census that we've all heard about. And we don't know if after Jesus is born, they decide, well, let's just live here for a while. The relatives are here, good babysitting. Like, we need some help with this little kid. And so maybe they decide to keep living there. Maybe they're living with relatives. Maybe they buy a house. We don't know. But they stay in Bethlehem, and they're now either at a relative's house or their own house. They're not in the manger anymore. They're at their own house. Jesus is playing in his pack and play or whatever it is. You know, things are going on, and the Magi show up. And they come into the house, and they see Mary, and they see Jesus playing on the ground. And it says they fall down, and they worship him. They bow down. They pay the respects to who they perceive is a new king. But Matthew tells us they actually did something else. That they actually gave Jesus something. Which is a bit odd. What do you give when you're magi, when you come from a distant land, when you're dignitaries from Persia and you show up and there's this one-year-old little boy? What do you give to him? You know, did they check, you know, the registry? Was it like a baby shower thing? Were there diapers? Like, what would they give to this one-year-old little boy? Well, you know what they gave because we all know the story, right? Let's keep reading. Matthew tells us the next part of the verse. Then they opened their treasures, or their treasure boxes, the word means. And they presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. So they came to pay the respects and to pay their worship to this great king, but it wasn't just enough to worship him and honor him with their words and with their lips. It wasn't enough to just call him the king and even to bow down in front of him. They realized that they needed to give him something physical, something tangible, something to demonstrate that they really did see him as a king. They needed to give him their treasure. That's what they did. So they gave gold. Gold in that day was just like it is today. It was a precious metal. It was very expensive, and it was worth a lot of money. It would have been their finest. Frankincense and myrrh were aromatic spices and perfumes, and those things don't mean much to us today. We read those, and we've always kind of wondered, what's the big deal about those? But in that time, they were very costly. And only the wealthy would have had frankincense and myrrh. Only people who had means. They represented extravagance. They represented riches. They represented treasure. Someone's best. In a sense, what these magi were doing, were saying, we want to give our finest treasure, our finest, the most expensive, the best things, the most cherished things that we actually own and have. We want to give to you, Jesus. Now, did they give it to Jesus because he needed it? No. I mean, I'm sure Mary and Joseph were grateful. I'm sure it helped, you know, a little bit to have these really expensive things given to them. I'm sure they were blown away by these men showing up and giving these treasures. But they didn't give the treasure to Jesus because he needed it. They gave their treasure to Jesus because he deserved it, because he was their king. And you don't give the king something that's not worth a lot. You give the king to show him he is the king, your finest treasure, your finest gifts. In a sense, they're saying our worship is important, but it's not enough to just sing songs or to just say words or to just express that we call you king. We need to demonstrate our worship in something physical and something tangible by giving to you as our king. Now, this story, when I read it in that way, it's convicting to me. Because it makes me ask the question, as somebody who's a follower of Jesus and who claims to call him my king, it makes me ask the question, do I worship him in that way? I mean, I come on Sundays and I sing songs just like you, and sometimes I really mean it and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I just sort of mouth the words and make my way through the songs. But then there's other times where I really mean it and I feel like God is speaking to me and I'm worshiping him, but I'm not even sure it's enough to just worship with my words. It's almost as if this story is saying, if I really believe you're the king, and if I really serve you as a king, it means that what's in my heart and the words I use will be expressed in my actions, and I'll take the finest things that I have, the finest things that I've owned, the finest things that I've earned, and I'll say, part of this is for you. I want to just give you these gifts, Jesus, to show that I worship you and honor you as my king. Because I've got a lot of treasure, and you probably do too. I don't have gold, frankincense, and myrrh, but I've got the equivalent of those things in my life, right? I mean, we're all fairly wealthy. We've all got a lot of stuff. We've got garages and homes and apartments and condos filled with stuff. And yet, truthfully, most of us don't give much of our treasure to Jesus. Most of us keep our treasure for ourselves. Now, it's kind of weird to talk about giving your treasure to Jesus because in our culture, it's not like we take like our jewelry and our money and like we find some altar and we just like put it down and then Jesus is like going to take it away and put it in his bank account. Like, that's not what it means to give treasure to Jesus. We know that the pattern of people in the Bible, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, the way they've given their treasure to Jesus is they give their wealth to the local church. They give it to the community of faith. They give it to the poor and the marginalized, orphans and widows, people who are near and dear to Jesus' heart. They give it to charities and organizations who are doing his work in the world. They give by investing in what God is doing in the world. That's how we give our treasure to him. And so the question is, how well are we doing that? I want to show you just a couple of statistics real quick. This is from, we'll put these on the screen. This is from Americans in general. 5% give 10% or more of their income to the church or to charity. We often call that tithing. 15% give between 2 and 10% of their income away. 50% give between 0 and 2% of their income away. And 30% give nothing. So, again, this is all Americans. This is just a general statistic. But a lot of us don't give anything away. Some give more away. Some even more. But only 5% of all Americans take 10% of or more of all of their treasure and say, I want to give this to what God is doing in the world. Now, guess what? I want to put one other thing at the bottom of the screen. The average American household will spend about $700 on Christmas gifts and decorations alone this year. It's really easy to spend a lot of money on ourselves, to keep our treasure for ourselves and our celebrations and even gifts for others, good gifts. And yet it's hard for us to give and be invested in what God is doing and to give our treasure to him. Now, we're different at New Denver Church, right? I mean, we're really generous, and I believe that. We're a generous community of faith. But let's look at some statistics for us. Because we're a 501c3. As a nonprofit organization, we track what people or how different groups of people give here at New Denver. So let me just show you some statistics for us. For New Denver attendees, 6% of us give $10,000 or more to New Denver Church. Now, I don't know what percentage that is because we don't know what people's incomes are, so we can't track that. But 6% give $10,000 or more. 7% give between $6,000 and $10,000. 28% give between $1,000 and $6,000. 19% give less than $1,000. And 40% of people who attend regularly give nothing. Now, this is only our church. I'm guessing a lot of people represented here give to all kinds, give in other ways, give to other organizations, give to other charities, give their treasure to God in some other form or fashion. And yet even this shows how difficult it is for us to just give a little bit of what we have away to what God is doing in our own community of faith that we all worship and we're a part of and we call our community of faith. Again, it's easier for us to spend more money on Christmas and on gifts for other people and on gifts for ourselves than it is to invest in what God's doing here. Now, before you think I'm pointing the finger at anyone else, let me share personally. Because I was taught at a young life from my parents to give a portion of my income away to God and what he's doing. And I've always done that. It's actually been somewhat easy. When Janice and I got married, we decided here's a portion of our income, here's a percentage we want to give to the church every year or every month. And here's another little percentage we want to give to other efforts, charities or missionaries we support, or just needs that God like points out in our lives. And so we've always done that. And it's even weird as a pastor because when you give to your local church, you're giving to the people who actually pay you. And that's always odd and weird. And yet we just feel like God's called us to do this because we feel like that's what God is doing in our midst. And we want to be a part of that. Well, earlier this year, we hit one of those seasons where you go through those months where your checking account gets really low. Anybody had that happen recently? All of us? Yes. Where your checking account gets really low and you have bills you got to pay and all those things have to happen. And I just realized, so I went in online and I stopped our giving to the church for a month. And we've got it set up. You can set up, we have this online thing where you can just give straight out your checking account every month. And so I stopped it because we needed to pay some bills and we get paid from some different places. You know how that works. Like things have to get shifted around to make it happen. So we stopped it and then I'll start it back up once next month happens and we get things shifted around. And I forgot. And I didn't start it back up. So we went through the rest of this year that way, and it hit me like a month ago. And I went in, and I was like, because we've had a little bit more money in our checking account. It's been kind of nice, right? It hasn't lasted long. We've figured out a way to spend it on ourselves, you know, and there's new tires you need to get, and the kids need braces, and there's all kinds of stuff. So I go in a month ago, and I realize, like, oh, we never turned that back on. Like, we haven't been giving for like the last 9 or 10 months to anything. So I figured out, well, I'm going to calculate how much we need to give to make up at the end of the year what we should have been giving all along. And it's a lot. And we didn't budget for that. And it's Christmas time, so it's definitely not in our budget. And I'm going like, oh, how do we do this? But then I ask the question, is Jesus my king? Like is he our king? Do I say that every Sunday? Yeah. Do I sing about that every Sunday? Yeah. Do we celebrate that at Christmas? Yeah. Does he deserve our finest gifts? Yeah. Because after all, he gave it to me to begin with. It's like he's given me everything in my life to begin with. And he said, hey, I just want you to take a portion of it and give it back to me and invest in what I'm doing in the world. And here's the deal. I don't want it because I need it. I want it because what you do with your treasure indicates where your heart is. And if you really see me and believe in me and trust in me as your king, then your treasure will follow your heart. And so we don't give to Jesus because he needs it. And you might even be here today and you might say, well, I'm not that wealthy. Like, I don't have treasure. I don't have riches. I don't have those kind of things. And I would say, you know what? Jesus told a story one time about a woman who put 2 pennies in the offering plate. And he said she contributed more than the people who gave tons of money because for her, it was her finest gift. It was her finest treasure. And she gave out of the overflow of her heart. And she sees me as the true king. So, how do we give our treasure to him? I don't know. This isn't a how message. You'll have to go home and figure out how to do that and ask that question on your own. But if you feel a little convicted or challenged in any way like I have, then maybe together we can all go home today and ask the question, God, how can we give our finest gifts to you? We really do want to worship and serve you as our king. And like the Magi, we want to declare that, and then we want to take our treasure and say, you're our king. We want to invest in what you're doing. Let me pray. Father God, we pray this morning that as we sing these songs during Christmas time and as we worship you, that you would help us to see what we can give to you during this season. And God, we know you don't need our money. We know you don't need our treasure or our riches. We know the church doesn't need it. This isn't about New Denver Church or charities or organizations. It's about just living our whole lives out as we follow you and giving from every part of our lives, even from our finances. And so God, we want to do that today. And I pray as we go home that you would help each one of us to wrestle with that in our own circumstances, in our own way. How can we bring our finest gifts to you today? And how can we continue to declare that you, like the Magi saw you, how can we see you as the king in our lives? We pray this in your name. Amen.